Hello, I'm delighted to say that this episode of Film Stories is sponsored by NordVPN. Now, if you're unfamiliar with a VPN, it is a virtual private network, and it's a service that basically allows you to pretend that your computer or device is in a different country. So you set a virtual location for your device, and that means that suddenly you can get access to things that otherwise you might not be able to see. So for instance, if you're a Netflix subscriber, you set your NordVPN to America, then you get a plethora of options from American Netflix rather than UK Netflix, which is where this podcast is based. You can do this with all sorts of things. You switch the virtual location of your VPN service, and then you get access to TV shows, to films, to sporting events, streaming services and such like that you just wouldn't be able to get from the UK. A quick mention too for the cybersecurity features of NordVPN, including shielding your online activities, encrypting your connection, and using threat protection as well. To take advantage of this, you need to go to nordvpn.com/filmstories. That's nordvpn.com/filmstories. And you can try it risk-free with a 30-day money-back guarantee to get the best discount off your NordVPN plan. If you go to that Film Stories link, that will give you an extra 4 months free on top of the 2-year plan. And again, there's no risk with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. And you will also find the link in the podcast episode description box. Hello, this is Simon Broom. I'm the editor of Film Stories magazine. And a very, very warm welcome
it's murder on the dance floor.
To the Film Stories podcast.
You better not kill the groom, DJ. Gonna burn this goddamn house right down.
4, 3, 2, 1.
Come with me.
And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
In movies. Movies that had stories.
The story just sucks them in.
This is just the beginning.
Stories. We would be honored if you would join us.
Hello and a very warm welcome to Film Stories with Simon Brew. I am Simon Brew. As always, that's absolutely everything you need to know about me. The aim of the podcast, though, well, is given away by the title. I'm here to talk of the stories of films, and I tend to talk about development stories, production stories, marketing stories, release stories, dancing round naked stories, things like that. All the ingredients, really, that go towards making the films that we know and sometimes love just that, the films that we know and sometimes love. The films I tend to cover on this podcast lean more towards the mainstream than anything else. They're films I'm interested in or invested in to some degree. I try not to do snark. I try not to punch down. This podcast is a celebration of cinema and a real appreciation that somehow, in the midst of all the madness, films manage to get made. Now, each episode I cover 2 films, and so I'm going to get on with it pretty quickly. Just to say, I apologise for missing an episode last week. It doesn't happen very often. I was under the weather and I was quite ill. I won't tell you all the details. Instead, I'll get on with the first of the 2 films I'm talking about in this episode of the podcast. As always, I'm going to set it up with a trailer, which should allow you time to get into suitable attire for us to talk about Saltburn.
Take my bike.
Hey, that is so kind. Thank you. I'm sorry I don't know your name. I'm Felix.
Oliver.
Oliver. Mm. Oliver, I love you. I love you. All right, cheers, Ollie.
My parents, they've got problems.
What kind of? What do you mean, problems?
I don't think I'll ever go home again.
Well, why don't you come home with me? Come to Saltburn.
Mr. Quick.
Wow.
And here he is now.
Oh, what beautiful eyes. Oh, how wonderful.
Yeah, I told you he wasn't a minger.
Oh, but darling, you're kind about everyone. You can't be trusted.
I had them hang up an old school dinner jacket. We dressed for dinner here.
Dressed for dinner?
Yeah, it was like black tie.
I think I like you even more than last year's one.
You're so,
So what?
Real.
That then was a clip from 2023's Saltburn, written and directed by Emerald Fennell, and starring Barry Keoghan, Jacob Elordi, Rosamund Pike, Richard E. Grant, Archie Madekwe, Alison Oliver, and you get some Carey Mulligan for your money in there as well. A fairly famous, infamous film, depending on how you look at it, at the point this has been recorded in early 2024. The actual genesis of Saltburn came to Emerald Fennell she described it as 6, 7, 8 years ago. So, I mean, we're looking back in 2016, 2017, when she hadn't at that point in her career directed her first feature. At the point we're talking now, I mean, she was certainly on her way up. She'd written the sitcom Drifters at this point, and she was hired to oversee the second season of the hugely successful series Killing Eve, was doing acting work as well. I mean, she'd had a recurring role in Call the Midwife for, what, 4 or 5 years, turned up in an awful lot of stuff. But the turn towards directing would begin in earnest with 2020's Promising Young Woman. One hell of a way, really, to announce yourself. She'd done a short film, Careful How You Go, in 2018 by this point as well. But talking to Screen Daily about just the idea for Saltburn, which again came to her before she'd made a film, she said that a film idea usually starts with me as a flash of something visual. And in this case, this film started 7 or 8 years ago with an image of someone licking the bottom of the bathtub. And she argued, you know everything from that image. That's about somebody wanting something they can't have when we're in the grip of a really intense desire. And she says, I don't think licking the bottom of the bathtub feels that transgressive. She says, desire is not all candles and jazz. It can be more sinister. And that was her jumping in point. I will say at this point, I think I prefer showers to baths. It's not much of a spoiler to suggest that the bathtub licking does make its way into the final cut of Saltburn many, many years later. It is one of the most famous scenes in the film. There are other most famous scenes in the film as well, but this is a spoiler-like podcast. So if you've not seen it, you're going to have to discover them for yourself. Let's move forward to 2020's Promising Young Woman that Emerald Fennell wrote and directed, the first woman ever to be nominated for a Best Director Oscar for her debut feature. She also took home an Oscar for her screenplay for the film for Best Original Screenplay. She took home at BAFTAs as well. But even at this point, Saltburn had been in her head for some time. It wasn't the only project there either. Now, she would discuss how her process when she came up with an idea and started coming up with a script was to work things over and over and over in her head, first of all. And only at that point, once she got them into some kind of shape internally, would she kind of shape them and get to a point where she felt she could write it out as a screenplay. She decided that Saltburn was going to be a film seen from the point of view of its lead character. She knew that. And she also knew she was going to set this at likely Oxford University, possibly Cambridge University, but she'd attended Oxford. And she was also set the film around the time that she was there, 2007-ish. She wanted a less than idyllic view of student life. She wanted sticky floors. She wanted sick in the sink. She wanted the things that films just didn't tend to show of the university experience unless they're going very much down that particular road. And so she was juggling that as the other parts of her career were also firing. And As she was on the awards run for Promising Young Woman, it didn't look at that point from the outside looking in that really Saltburn was going to be her next priority project. Because in March 2021, she was hired by Warner Brothers to pen a comic book movie. She was hired to write an adaptation, it was reported, of the DC comic character Zatanna. Now, she didn't mention that she was directing at the time. The report certainly didn't mention she was directing at the time. But also, there was a little bit of a time slip here, which she cleared up on the Happy, Sad, Confused podcast. Because she explained then that her involvement with Zatanna, even though it was reported after Promising Young Woman came out, it actually happened before the film had happened. And she said, this was something I was working beforehand, and it was when J.J. Abrams had just arrived at Warner Brothers and was going to reboot the dark universe of presumably DC Comics characters rather than the universal dark universe of horror, which I should come to on a future episode of the podcast. And Fennell explained they were going to kind of make this new kind of sort of dark sort of villain universe or hero villain universe. And she thought Zatanna was the coolest of them. J.J. Abrams' team at Bad Robot production company was working on it. Hannah, his producer at Bad Robot, was so cool, Fennell explained, and so interesting. And she just said, I love genre of all kinds. Got to work on a script. She did complete a script as well. But the changes were afoot at Warner Brothers and DC City Studios, and an entire slate in the end, really, of superhero films was just quietly retired in favour of the path that the studio is now on towards a new Superman movie in 2025. But Saltburn was now bubbling up, and a myriad of touch points, really, some more overt than others. Merchant Ivory films, the film The Dreamers, Atonement, Stealing Beauty, Brideshead Revisited, Cruel Intentions was in her head as well. We'll come to a couple more in a second. And Fennell also had some backing too, because Lucky Chap Entertainment is the production company of Margot Robbie, and Robbie had backed Promising Young Woman and was clearly going to be on board for Saltburn as well. And so it got to a point where in May 2022, just over a year after she won the Oscar, Saltburn was clearly going to be Emerald Fennell's second directorial outing. In May of 2022, Rosamund Pike was announced. She was announced in the lead role, actually, in one of the trade press reports that I picked up. Not quite how it panned out, a bit more ensemble-y, and also Barry Keoghan would effectively take the lead role in the film. But Fennell, who at this time was also in the cast of Barbie, which was shooting around this point, was about to shoot, was clearly in the midst of casting, because as soon as Rosamund Pike was announced, 2 or 3 days later, we got the news that Jacob Elordi was taking a key role. Barry Keoghan was taking a key role as well. And the idea then was at the end of May 2022, the film would go to the Cannes Film Festival, and hopefully someone would put up the money to not only make the movie but also distribute it. And inevitably, that's what happened. This proved to be a very, very in-demand project at Cannes that year. It was the Cannes Film Festival in person as well, and so that was a big draw. This was one of the films that a lot of people were interested in and due to bid on, and Amazon got its checkbook out. The amount of money it cost to make Saltburn was never really disclosed. The amount that Amazon paid to make Saltburn wasn't disclosed, and also the distribution deal. All of those numbers, though, well, they started to add up. Certainly the amount that Amazon would ultimately put into advertising the film was substantive. Part and parcel of the deal, as it would turn out, was clearly that Saltburn was going to end up on a big screen at some point. I don't think I was expecting it to get quite the big screen release that it got, but even before the Cannes Film Festival was done, a deal was in final negotiation, and it was reported that a summer 2020 shoot was being actively planned as well. That with Margot Robbie's company behind it, the financing and the distribution was quickly coming into place, and so the rest of the cast could just be slotted in. Carey Mulligan was in there early, actually. She'd earned an Oscar nomination, deservedly so, for Promising Young Woman, and she's friends with Emerald Fennell and read the script for Saltburn as a friend. And as Fennell would tell Time magazine, Mulligan then asked if she could take on the supporting role of Pamela, or poor dear Pamela, in the film, which Fennell was glad to sign her up for. In the August, after filming had begun, really, there was the casting announcements of Archie Madekwe, Alison Oliver and Richard E. Grant. Now, they were clearly on board beforehand, but still, it was at a point where filming was pressing ahead. The final roles were just being finalised. Even at that point, though, Emerald Fennell was insistent that Barry Keoghan was always her choice for the key role of Oliver Quick in the film. Now, at this point, he hadn't picked up his own Oscar nomination for the film The Banshees of Inisherin for Martin McDonagh. That would happen fairly soon after he was announced. It was his work, though, in a Yorgos Lanthimos film, The Killing of Sacred Deer, that really put him on Emerald Fennell's radar, and Barry Keoghan signed up for the risky role. He knew he was going out on a limb here. He signed up for the risky role of Oliver. It would prove to be quite a wise choice as well. It would also require a lot of preparation too, because going very, very spoiler light, there is a dance sequence towards the end of Saltburn that needed a lot of choreographing in order to make it work. Now, Barry Keoghan's background at one stage was in boxing, and so in came Polly Bennett as the movement coach ahead of the shooting of the film to work with Keoghan, and basically played on his boxing background in the choreography that was put together for the particular sequence that I'm talking about, that I'm not going to spoil. Heading into production, there were clearly more touch points coming forward as well. L.P. Hartley's novel, The Go-Between, is one that Emerald Fennell talked about, as well as the Joseph Losey film, The Servant. That is a great film that I only watched for the first time a few months ago. Really, really good. And also the name Brideshead Revisited was popping up as well. The talented Mr. Ripley got a name check too. Ahead of filming of the movie, there was time for rehearsal with the actors. And this, I mean, there's improvisation built into Saltburn, although the improvisation that was going on in rehearsals would lead to Emerald Fennell going back to the screenplay and just doing a little bit of tuning to it with some of the stuff that her actors came up with. Linus Sandgren was hired to shoot the film. Victoria Boydell was going to do the editing of it. Anthony Willis on music. And filming could begin on July the 4th, 2022. And it took place at a house in Northamptonshire here in the UK called Drayton House, a house that dates back hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. A big estate house that has over 100 rooms in it, as well as a hedge maze, land feature pools described out as well. Basically, let's just go with it's much bigger than my house. But because this location had been secured, it meant a few things. First of all, there are key moments in the film that they could work with, that they would be able to shoot on this location, as you would hope. Also, it would turn out the actors had the option of living on the same estate where the film was being shot. Rosamund Pike would talk about how she would basically live on the location of the film. Now, amongst the toughest bits to shoot, well, Emerald Fennell would say that the opening shot that takes place at Oxford and also a party sequence that happens in the movie were the hardest bits, that the party alone needed 280 members of cast. Now, just to make, I mean, blame the writer, right? Just to make it a little bit more complex, it's a costume party as well, and a proper full-on party. This wasn't going to be a polite movie one with people standing around. Remember those dirty sticky floors? They were going to be in full abandon here. That basically what this therefore needed was a 280 costumes for the cast, not just like everyday character costumes. This was a costume party, so they needed to be relatively elaborate, and so that took a reasonable amount of shepherding just to be able to bring to the screen. For Margot Robbie, the fact that her production company had both Barbie and Saltburn shooting roughly around the same time, that put demands on the producer of the film as well. And it got to a point where Barbie had wrapped filming, and then 2 weeks later, Robbie was said to be on the set of Saltburn as well. And she wasn't the only one who was going from one film to another really quite quickly as well, because Jacob Elordi, who plays Felix in the movie, well, he'd landed the role of Elvis Presley for Sofia Coppola in the movie Priscilla, and so at the points where he wasn't needed in front of the camera for his work on Saltburn, he would be off preparing to be Elvis. There's a sentence. He would be on the set of Priscilla just 3 weeks after Saltburn had wrapped up as well, and he would tell Vanity Fair that I'd shoot all day in London and then I'd go home to my Elvis cave, which was my hotel room, which was sort of all pictures of Priscilla as well. There was room for improvisation, as I mentioned before, and there is a famous sequence from the film, or infamous, that takes place by the side of a grave. Again, spoiler light. And so Barry Keoghan talked about this to Variety, and he said that the gravesite was sort of like a collaboration with me and Emerald. And he just said, on the day, I was like, can I try something? He said, I wanted to see what the next level of obsession was. So I asked for a closed set. I wanted to see where it went. And he said, it could have gone completely wrong, but I think it moved the story. Just to touch on the shooting of the dancing moment in the film as well. They did 11 takes of it in the end, and Fennell would talk about this in a separate piece with Variety, and just said the seventh actually was the bit where they got it, quote, technically perfect. And she said, you could hear everyone's overjoyed response, but I had to say sorry, because it was missing whatever it was that made Oliver that slightly human messiness. It was, in a way, it was slightly too perfect by the sounds of it. And Fennell would say, we had to do it a further four times. It is a sequence that goes on for quite a period of time. And so the setting up and the resetting and doing take after take after take after take of that would be, let's just describe it as quite a day. But then I think most days on the shoot of Saltburn were, could be described as quite a day for Barry Keoghan, because he would chat about how he prepared for this character that, as you would hope, evolves over the course of the film. And he described his process as basically coming up with five different versions of the character, and he would have them all on tap, ready to go for whatever bit needed to be shot at a given point. He talked about how, I created Oliver 1 for the start, then Oliver 2 for the next part, on through Oliver 5 at the end. And his explanation was, I wanted to hit each of them with a physicality, a tone of voice, a different motive, a different pace. And he argues, you see the costume and the hair changes, but you also sense his mental change and track that journey. Now, Saltburn is not a film, as most films aren't, that was shot chronologically. And what that meant was Emerald Fennell was needing to call on different Barry Keoghans, or more to the point, different Olivers, at different points through the day. And Keoghan did admit that part of the challenge was having to shift to be, say, Oliver 2 at one point in the day, then Oliver 4, then he had to be ready on the spot to make that jump as and when required. Filming wrapped up on September the 16th, 2022. Post-production went on, I think it was through to about the summer of 2023. There was a lot to be done on the sound side of things. A quick shout out to a friend of the podcast, Nina Hartston here, who was the sound supervisor on the movie. Quite a catalogue of songs needed to be licensed as well. You heard at the very start of this podcast, Sophie Ellis-Bextor's song, Murder on the Dance Floor. I'll come to that in a second. The most expensive Fennell admitted to Awards Watch in the end was Achilles' track, Mr. Brightside. That was the one that cost the most money to be able to put into the film. But once they'd locked the music in, and that required quite a check, it's a good job Amazon was paying in order to do so, then it was screened with a view of getting film festivals interested, and boy were they interested in the film. It was quickly chosen to open the 2023 London Film Festival, for instance. Also, it went to the Telluride Film Festival, which is where the film would ultimately debut on the 31st of August 2023. It would come to London just over a month after that, and it would do a little bit of film festival work before it would get any kind of wide release, although that was coming shortly. The response was, well, I mean, if you've seen the film, you'll understand it. The critical response to the film was quite scattergun, really, that if you go with Saltburn, you really, really love Saltburn a lot. However, there was a lot of drawing comparison, really, with Promising Young Woman. That I love the film Promising Young Woman. It is a far more straight down the line movie, I would suggest, not without its twists and turns, but I would suggest Saltburn is the least conventional of the two. And whenever you put a less conventional movie in front of people, particularly one that has its moments of debauchery and scenes in bathrooms, well, that's going to create a very divisive collection of reactions. That is exactly what the film got. That if you love it, you love it. But generally, I think the critical leaning was more towards Promising Young Woman being the better film. And there wasn't really a suggestion. I certainly didn't get it from the initial wave of critical responses, good and bad, of just what Saltburn was going to become 3-4 months down the line. The film did get a cinema release. Amazon did put its money where its mouth was. And on the 17th of November 2023, it landed in UK cinemas. It would land in US cinemas just the day before as well. Warner Brothers would handle the theatrical distribution of it. It was not a huge cinema release, but it was certainly enough to get noticed and to chart. That Saltburn opened, let's go to the US box office chart, November the 17th to the 19th, 2023. There's Saltburn in 14th place on just, I mean, this is the crucial thing, on just 7 screens, a screen average of $46,000, comfortably the highest in the chart. The other films that were around, I mean, the number one movie that weekend was The Hunger Games, The Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes with 44 million. Trolls That Band Together was out. Thanksgiving was out. The other, I'm loath to say smaller releases, but the other that had a bit more of an eye on the award season that was just just in the throes of happening. Well, Next Goal Wins opened. That was its first week with $2.5 million on 2,240 screens. Priscilla had been out actually for four weeks at this point. So Jacob Elordi's Elvis was in ninth place with a total of $16 million banked at that point. And then Fallen Leaves opened on two screens for a screen average of $24,000. The following week, as Saltburn's screen count went up dramatically to 1,500 screens, it broke into the top 10 in ninth place with a $1.8 million opening weekend as Ridley Scott's Napoleon popped along. The Disney film Wish opened as well. Those two got $20 and $90 million respectively as The Hunger Games held on to the top spot. Saltburn wouldn't be doing an awful lot of business at the box office though. It would be comfortably out of the top 10 the following week as a whole bunch of other stuff, including Godzilla Minus One, Animal, The Shift, Silent Night, all popped along. And by the time Saltburn was done in US cinemas, it had done its job actually. $11.4 million outside of the US, $9.6 million. So its box office gross was $21 million. But Saltburn was always intended by Amazon for streaming in the end, and Amazon gave it a juicy, just about pre-Christmas Day slot on its Prime Video service, and soon it began to soar. Now, the film already had awareness because the way that it was marketed was interesting. That they didn't market it in quite the traditional way, that a lot of the clips that were put out were just really, really snappy and short, 10, 15 seconds each. They didn't want to give the film away. In fact, for a long period, Saltburn was under a very heavy veil of secrecy. They were reluctant to do a traditional trailer, and so these short little snippets kind of played to how Saltburn would help find its audience once it landed on streaming as well. There was also hand in hand the resurgence of the Sophie Ellis Bextor song Murder on the Dance Floor, that by the end of 2023, the song was right back up the charts, was being downloaded scary amounts of time, and it clearly had given that a fresh lease of life as well. Emerald Fennell actually would explain of the sequence that involves that song, that quote, "It's joyful, but also it's an act of desecration and it's an act of ownership and territory establishment." The film, when it landed on Prime Video, that's where really it went nuts, absolutely nuts. That the viral marketing had already put it in people's minds. Then as soon as people could watch it and had heard noises based on the theatrical release of the film, well, first of all, the viewing numbers on Prime Video were very, very high. Amazon would rank it as one of its top 10 worldwide film debuts ever. Ever, as if it's been doing it for a long time, but you know what I mean. Just it was significant in the annals of Amazon streaming. In fact, just at the point this has been recorded, Doug Liman's Roadhouse movie, I think, has broken the records for Amazon streaming service. But Saltburn was hugely successful, and the word of mouth meant people were coming back to it and trying it. And videos based around Saltburn, here's one of the key statistics, were going particularly strongly on TikTok. That, get this, content creator. I love that phrase, a content creator. I always read it as content creator. I like that. People who are content create things. Isn't that nice? But 4 billion views on TikTok of Saltburn related material were helping power the movie to far beyond a film that did 21 million at the box office and was doing well on Prime Video as well. That this was becoming not just a word of mouth sensation, but a viral sensation, that it was going particularly strongly on social media. Clips were being shared left, right and centre, not least of two or three of the key sequences that I might have referred to during the telling of this story. What the film didn't do, and perhaps the fact that it was so unconventional really and against the expectation of what people were thinking, was interest too many of the big awards bodies. Now, the BAFTAs came out to fight for it. It got nominated for 5 BAFTAs: Outstanding British Film, Barry Keoghan for Best Actor, Best Supporting Actor Jacob Elordi, Best Supporting Actress Rosamund Pike, and Anthony Willis's score. Oscars couldn't be less interested. Nothing whatsoever whatsoever that the film did pick up a mix of awards. And certainly its production design is really quite something. But it wasn't winning an awful lot, really. And it was clear that as much as Amazon might have purchased this with a view of getting it into the Oscar race, where it was actually having success was in the old-fashioned art of getting people to watch and talk about a film. Saltburn, I would suggest, transcended the expectations of it, and it gave people not quite the film that they were expecting. And I think Amazon would admit, perhaps Emerald Fennell would admit, I can't talk for her obviously, that it took off in a way that they weren't really expecting. If it had gone a traditional route 10, 15 years ago, and I'm a huge, huge advocate of theatrical releases, I think they're very, very special. But the way that they did this by going theatrical and then streaming relatively quickly, that wasn't available 10, 15 years ago. Would Saltburn have hit in quite the same way? I don't know. Point was, it certainly did now, and it certainly continues to do so, even as this podcast is being recorded. And that brings me to the halfway point of this latest episode of Film Stories. As always, thank you for listening and thank you for your time. I'm going to do a few parish notices here because I've been up to a fair degree of mischief. First of all, if you like this podcast and don't mind supporting it, there are three key ways outside of lending it your ears. Thank you for lending it your ears that you can do so. All of these are appreciated. If you want to support financially what I'm up to, then go to patreon.com/SimonBrew, please. Put some money in the pot there. You get the podcast early and ad-free, apart from the one time where, for some reason, it didn't upload a week or two ago. I apologise for that. You also get the gossip of what we're up to behind the scenes, too. Costing you nothing is just leaving a review at your podcast home of choice. Ideally, a hugely positive review. Stuff like that really, really helps. Likewise, if you could subscribe to the podcast, I'd massively appreciate that, too. And then print magazines. I want to talk about print magazines because since I last recorded an episode of Film Stories, I've done two more. Film Junior issue 16 is on sale now. That leads with interviews done by young reporters with Jack Black and Awkwafina. Really, really proud of that. A film magazine for under 15 year olds. Print film magazine that is also partly written by them too. And then I've got issue 49 of Film Stories magazine, which is just about to go on sale. This is a hugely special one for me. A bit of a manifesto, really, given that I have put 10 independent UK films on the front cover. The front cover and more details will all be appearing at store.filmstories.co.uk, which is where you can buy both of those publications. Thank you to everyone who passes on the word and just helps this bizarre project that we came up with continue somehow to keep going. But I think that's enough parish notices, isn't it? Let me move on to the second of the two films I'm going to talk about in this episode of Film Stories. There's a bit of a marketing theme to this one as well. I'm moving up to 2024. These are very recent movies at the point of recording. I'm going to play you a clip from the trailer. Come to the story of this, the other side, just of this little taster.
Oh, hell no!
Move.
Hey, PG-13, please.
What was that?
Oh, Lord, it's the queen bee.
Regina George.
Don't look her in the eye!
You could be really hot if you change, like, everything. I met a
guy in the summer and I left him in the spring. Welcome to Health and Human Sexuality.
We'll be getting into abstinence, of course, then followed by in the spring, condoms and choking.
You're learning things now that I don't know how to teach.
Are you okay in there? We're concerned you're either doing drugs or having a toilet baby.
Ew.
We as women have to be able to support each other.
Get in, loser.
Welcome, Katie.
You're never gonna believe what I found this morning.
Your burn book.
Mom, go make snacks.
For sure.
That then was a clip from the trailer for Mean Girls, the 2024 Mean Girls. That's definitely not a musical, coming to that shortly. Directed by Samantha Jane and Arturo Perez Jr. Screenplay by Tina Fey, based on the previous film Mean Girls, which I'll come to shortly as well. Starring Anjali Rice, Rene Rapp, Aulie Carvalho, Jackie Spivey, Avantika, Bibi Wood, Christopher Briney, Jenna Fisher, Busy Phillips, Tina Fey and Tim Meadows. And so the origins of 2024 Mean Girls obviously lie in 2004's Mean Girls, a film that I've not yet come to on this podcast that I really should and really will at some point. Now, that film, let's go all the way back there, was directed by Mark Waters and was written by Tina Fey, based on Rosalind Wiseman's Queen Bees and Wannabes. Now, Mean Girls, when it came out, had a budget of, what, about $18 million, and it did about $130 million worldwide. It was a hit movie, but its reputation has continued to soar. Beautifully acidic teen comedy. I love Mean Girls an enormous amount. And the film, over time, began to enjoy a second life courtesy of the stage. Not to say that there hadn't been an earlier attempt to capitalise on its success, because in 2011, a straight-to-DVD sequel to Mean Girls emerged called Mean Girls 2. Who'd have thunk it? None of the original team were involved with that. It didn't have the bite. It didn't have anywhere near the impact of the original Mean Girls either. But it was just a year or two after the release of that sequel that a different project reared its head. Because in 2013, Tina Fey announced that plans were now afoot for a Broadway musical based on the 2004 film. She was also involved in it. She was writing the book for the musical. Jeff Richmond was doing the music. Neil Benjamin was in doing the lyrics as well. And it would take a little bit of time to come together, as you would expect, but still, it debuted in 2017 and would eventually make its way to Broadway. I say eventually, it happened really quickly. And also, it made its money back really quickly. As well, Mean Girls was one of those rarest of musicals that turned out to be a pretty instant success, that the reviews were good. It got a lot of award nominations as well, and it looked actually like Mean Girls might run for some time until a pandemic got in the way. I'm coming to that shortly as well. Now, it was a month after the release of another big screen musical, 2019's Cats. What happened to that? That it was announced a film version of the Mean Girls musical was on the stove. Tina Fey revealed the news in January 2020, and Paramount was going to back this via its Paramount Players label. And in a statement, she said, "I'm very excited to bring Mean Girls back to the big screen." She said, "It's been incredibly gratifying to see how much the movie and the musical have meant to audiences." At that point, she remarked that, "I've spent 16 years with these characters now. They are my Marvel universe and I love them dearly." Now, there was conversations about, do you bring the stage personnel over, but while no director was confirmed at this point, the project was certainly moving, and Fey had to get to work on getting the script together for the film. Things went quiet, though, throughout 2020. I wonder why. The small matter of a global pandemic obviously changed lots of things, changed lots of working practices as well. And also, Tina Fey was working on the show Mr. Mayor at this point, too. And so we'd have to wait some 14 months before we got a further update on the state of the Mean Girls musical film. This came in May 2021, where she gave an interview to Variety. And she revealed at that point that, quote, "we're still relatively early on. We're looking for a director right now." And she also noted, "the first time we had new actors play these roles on Broadway, it was like breaking the seal." And so she'd accepted at that point, now these roles belong to more than one set of actors. And she said, "I'm excited to see who ends up being in the movie." Now, this was the first strong hint that it wouldn't be that Broadway cast of the late 2010s that were going to lead the film. In fact, the genesis time of the movie ultimately counted them out to a large degree as well, as Fey would note that they'd aged 4 years really at the point that they were discussing the film. And so, given that this is a teen movie and set in a high school as well, what they couldn't really have was actors who were notably not the age of the characters in the big screen version of the movie. Fey did admit to Variety that she considered directing, but also she noted it wasn't at that stage for her. She said, "I really respect directors who think in pictures," and instead she was going to be behind the scenes primarily, although she would be persuaded to appear before the camera as well. I'm coming to that shortly too. By September 2021, the directors had been found for the movie, and it was a duo. It was Samantha Jane and Arturo Perez Jr. happened to be a couple as well. This was their directorial feature debut, and Paramount Players was backing the movie. The idea there was that this was going to go to the relatively new Paramount Plus streaming service at that point, that this looked like a smart one to just make for streaming as things stood, came with an inbuilt audience as well, and overcame the uncertainty about whether people would turn up to watch this theatrically. Rumours were being bandied around in the autumn of 2021 that there would be room in the new film, potentially for the key members of the original cast, names such as Rachel McAdams and Lindsay Lohan and Amanda Seyfried. Contextually too, it's just worth noting that the musical itself had closed at this point, that when Broadway theatres opened up after the initial onslaught of the pandemic, that Mean Girls was not one of the shows that returned to the stage. That didn't have a massive impact on casting. Okay, there wasn't an active musical cast at that point, but it would have been easy to dip into the ensemble should they have chosen to do so. Yet the subject of bringing back people from the 2004 film, questions would continue to be asked, and Rachel McAdams, for one, would finally address this some way down the line after the release of the film. And she told Variety that Tina Fey and her had sort of, quote, dabbled with a few ideas, but it was tough to make it all work in the end. She said, "I was really down for whatever she wanted to do." And Rachel McAdams was happily pushing the film, saying the direction it went in would be fantastic. "I can't wait to see it." So this was just a month or two before the release of the movie. But casting still would take a little bit more time. And in fact, there's an awful lot of work going on behind the scenes, just getting things ready. Because what they were having to shape was effectively a three-hour Broadway musical into a much slimmer film. I mean, it had gone from a slim film to a long musical to, well, it needed to go back to some degree of slim film. And so, as Arturo Perez would note, there were countless conversations just about what to cut and how to cut and what needed to be trimmed just to keep the running time to something a bit more cinematic. At one point, they cut one of the key songs from the film, Apex Predator, and Perez admitted they were just like, "What are we doing?" But 14 songs from the stage musical were cut out of the film in the end. Now, not everything was a casualty. I mean, Samantha Jane would say that, I mean, there was a song called Stop, and that was one that didn't make it. And she just said it was a classic Broadway song. It plays so well on stage, but it wasn't advancing the story. And she argued, in cinema, you don't have 3 hours. It has to be tight. It has to keep moving. But with almost on the same argument, Samantha Jane and Arturo Perez did fight for a song called Sexy, and this also, Samantha Jane argued, didn't advance the plot. In fact, they had to rework bits of the plot in order to make it work in the film. There was a line taken out of previous iterations relating to weight as well, and the directors did admit that some updating had been done on the language and just the just bits of depiction, really. And Jane would argue, "It was important to us and everybody to update this in a way that resonates with teens now." And she said, "Luckily, the way we speak about bodies has come such a long way. Things that flew back then would not fly now." Now, I couldn't work out if she was referring to the stage musical or the original film that comment, but she did say weight should absolutely not be tied to popularity or any of that, and she just said the updates are really important. There were other updates as well, because moving contextually on, the world of teens in 2024 is very different to the world of teens in 2004, technology being the most obvious one. Social media and its dominance over life a very, very pertinent and obvious one, and they needed to reflect that. They needed to get that into the film, but not let it overpower the movie. And so that was the job of Tina Fey with her screenplay, which she duly delivered, and it did reflect an awful lot of this while keeping the original Mean Girls at heart. Faye, by this stage, had been persuaded to return on screen. She did take some persuading. Tim Meadows from the original film was also going to come back too. And it was in December 2022, really, that things finally accelerated. That's when casting was fully underway, with Renee Rapp cast in the role of Regina, the key role of Regina. She had played her on stage, and she was given the role on the big screen. And at this point, as well in December 2022. Anjaye Rice and Aulii Carvalho were also announced, as was Jackel Spivey. And it was Christopher Briney actually was announced a little while after, but only after some reluctance with the singing side of it. And the songs for their character were cut out of the film. But then 14 songs were cut out of the film. So, you know, it wasn't that big a deal from what I can work out. Casting announcement would continue right up until the start of filming. I think John Hamm was one of the last through the door. It was lovely to see actually in the movie Jenna Fisher and Busy Phillips turning up in the ensemble too. And the shoot of the film would begin in March 2023, and it would be a brief shoot as well. It would be finished in April 2023. This was not a big prolonged shoot. It would film on location actually at a now disused high school, Mater Dei High School, which is in New Jersey in the US, that they were able to take over the building. Now, deep in the archives of this podcast, there's an interview with a man called Jeremy Garalick, who just made Murder Mystery 2. And one of the things that he did was he bought a high school. He bought a disused high school and set up a film studio within it. And it's quite an interesting story to listen to about how it saved an awful lot of money on filming really, and how many films have shot in this high school. The Mean Girls team were following the same idea. Let's not build anything, let's just find an old high school. Now, I will say, with the filming of the movie, one of the surprising things I found with the film was the musical numbers that are contained to, there's a couple that are contained to a corridor, and it did come across like they only had one corridor to work with at certain points. I don't know the inners of the high school. I just wonder what restrictions, if any, were in there at that point. There was, during the filming of the movie, a surprise cameo as well. So if you don't want to hear this, this is the point where you move forward about 5 minutes in the podcast, and hopefully we still remember to be friends. This was a cameo where everybody who was involved had to sign a very, very strict non-disclosure agreement. This was one of the film's big surprises. Because what do you know, one of the original stars was coming back to Mean Girls. That would be Lindsay Lohan. And as Samantha Jane would say, I remember the feeling when I learned that Lindsay was going to be a part of it. She said everyone was so happy. And the day that Lindsay Lohan was on set, and she did half a day on the film, there was a special energy that day. So now there was an energy in Lindsay Lohan's bank balance for the work as well. She got $500,000 for doing that half day. She would also be part of the promotion, turning up at the premiere of the film. But as Arturo Perez Jr. said, it was very NDA heavy, only on a need to know basis. And she said, I think it had sprinkled to some of the cast. And he said that, I do actually remember a couple of people snuck in that day, now that I'm thinking of it, but they were able to capture the scene and also protect the secret. This was not something that came out until very, very, very late in the day. And it's not as if questions weren't being asked. Now, in 2023, relevant to the Mean Girls story, Paramount had a big success at the box office. A horror movie by the name of Smile crossed $100 million just in the US alone. Now, Smile had originally been intended for release on the Paramount Plus streaming service, but a test screening had taken place, and off the back of that test screening, it was decided to upgrade the release of the film to a theatrical one, that it would get a full, in fact, as it turned out, a full worldwide cinema release, and it would turn out to be a very, very wise choice on Paramount's part. At the point this podcast has been recorded, Smile 2 is in production. And it was with that potentially in mind that, as test screenings were coming together for Mean Girls, Paramount's eyes were moved just a little bit. Because in September 2023, after those test screenings took place, came the news that the studio now decided to shift the movie to a theatrical release. Now, it's coming out in a relatively off-peak period of the year. January the 12th, 2024 was the release date. That's also the release date in the UK for Jason Statham in The Beekeeper. What a film that is. But this movie that had cost around $35 million to make, so relatively modest by modern standards, that had been designed for streaming services, well, now it was going to hit the big screen. Now, if Saltburn was a beneficiary of social media in its promotion and its marketing, and Saltburn, as we discussed, very small snippety bits of the film were put out, the marketing of Mean Girls 2024 was absolutely fascinating. That there's Mean Girls Day, which is October the 3rd. The original movie was released on the TikTok service in 23 separate clips. And so this basically got in a lot of eyeballs on the original film that hadn't been on the original film before. But also the first trailer came out for the movie as well. And, well, I mean, it just hid the fact that what you were getting was a musical. This was, I mean, this caused a large degree of conversation around the time. And so Paramount had basically made a decision, which I'll come to shortly, that it was not going to fully disclose what the film was. That notwithstanding, it went before critics at the start of 2024. The reception to the movie was pretty much in the middle. As much as the stage musical went down very well, as much as the original film got really, really strong reviews, this probably got it got better reviews than Mean Girls 2, but generally it felt like it was all right. Paramount was actively promoting it as "This is not your mother's Mean Girls." Many people who watched the film would suggest actually it was pretty much at heart the same Mean Girls as 20 years ago. But the performances were good, the music was fine. Was it necessary? Well, is any film necessary? There is an argument. But Paramount was ultimately going to win its gamble here, because it went out into cinemas on that weekend, the weekend of January the 12th, 2024. Its US opening was a real success for the studio. $28.6 million it grossed in its opening weekend, holding off the challenge of Jason Statham and his Bees in second place with $16.5 million. And two interesting breakout hits in their own way, those two movies. The other films around, I mean, The Book of Clarence had a week in cinemas that particular week. That opened with $2.5 million. But Wonka had been the number one movie for the best part of a month. That was knocked off the top spot. Anyone But You was around. Migration, Aquaman and the Lost Kingdom, Night Swim, The Boys in the Boat and The Iron Claw rounded out the rest of the top 10. Mean Girls and The Beekeeper then held out the top spots for the next week as well. Mean Girls lost 60% of its audience. Beekeeper lost 48%, but still another $11.6 million. Inside 2 weeks, Paramount had $50 million in the bank off its theatrical run just in the US. Week three, Mean Girls and The Beekeeper, both at the top of the chart. Mean Girls still holding on to the number one slot. It lost another 40% of business. Beekeeper had lost 22% of business. And it wouldn't be until Argyle popped along from Matthew Vaughn with a $17 million opening at the start of February that Mean Girls was relegated back. In fact, it went from number one to number six. Fairly quick drop. Beekeeper held in at third, if you're interested. By the time it left US cinemas, and it's only just about left US cinemas at the time this has been recorded, $72.4 million in the bank, another $30 million or so outside of the US, and Mean Girls, $100 million grossing movie, just in time for it to go onto the streaming service where Paramount had intended it in the first place. But in the aftermath of the film's release, a couple of things. First of all, I want to acknowledge that Lindsay Lohan was said to be, quite according to her representative in a piece with The Messenger, Lindsay was very hurt and disappointed by a specific reference, a joke that was in the film that I'm not going to repeat here, but I did just want to give air to that. A lot of the attention, though, was on the way that Paramount had elected to market the film. And in fact, in an article with Deadline, the global marketing and distribution head of Paramount, Mark Weinstock, answered the questions. And he argued there are two audiences for the film, the audience that grew up with Mean Girls and the audience that didn't. And so they did that TikTok thing, which worked and got non-fans interested in. But also what Weinberg said was, we didn't want to run out and say it's a musical, because people tend to treat musicals differently. He said, this movie is a broad comedy with music. Yes, it could be considered a musical, but it appeals to a larger audience. And what his argument was, and he's right on this actually, you can see in trailers for both Wonka and The Color Purple, the musical version of The Color Purple, they don't say musical either. Now, he did argue that we have a musical note on the title, so there are little hints to it without being overbearing, but it's a fairly little hint there, Mark. And it would be fair to say quite a few people were surprised when everybody started singing. Not as surprised as they were with Tim Burton's Sweeney Todd movie. I think that is really the poster child for hiding it's a musical. But still, Mean Girls, it is a musical, and only now, as it's coming to its home release, at the point, again, that this is being recorded, is Paramount being a little bit more candid about what we're ultimately getting. In 20 years' time, will we get all this again? Will we get a musical straight to DVD, Mean Girls 2? Imagine that. I pretty much doubt it. This sounds like Mean Girls' run is done, although a revival of the musical is on the way. It's coming to London, actually, in a couple of weeks from where I'm sitting. Mean Girls, though, two different films based on the same idea, really, and the script by the same person. It's a rare story, really. 20 years apart, two hit movies important to two slightly different audiences as well. You have to say, in the end, hats off, and not a bad bit of marketing either. And that brings me to the end of this latest episode of Film Stories. As always, thank you so much for listening and thank you for your time. If I've not bored you completely, I'm on Twitter and Blue Sky at Simon Brew. Film Stories is on them as well, at Film Stories. You can find Film Stories on Facebook at facebook.com/filmstoriesonline, on YouTube at youtube.com/filmstories. You can find our shop at store.filmstories.co.uk. Our website at filmstories.co.uk is updated every weekday with movie news, reviews, features, TV games. We're trying to make a clickbait free entertainment website, which is really hard to do, but damn it, we're giving it a go. Thank you to everybody who supports us there. And our Patreon again is patreon.com/simonbrew. Hopefully things are fully back up and running now. I'm over my little bit of lurgy, so I'm going to go off and watch a few more films. I will be back soon with another bunch of film stories. Until then, you all take care, you all look after yourselves. Main thing is you're all well, and thank you so much for listening. I'll be back soon with more film stories. Bye-bye.